Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, July 8, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call, as today we discuss Freddie, Fannie, the GSEs, and more. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're very pleased to welcome David H. Thompson as our expert today. He's the managing partner at the boutique law firm here in Washington, D.C., Cooper & Kirk. We're very pleased to have him with us. He's going to give us some background and then an update on the litigation. And as always, we'll be making himself available for questions from the audience. So please do be thinking of those questions as we go through the program. With that, Mr. Thompson, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon, Dean. Thank you very much, and good afternoon to all of you. This afternoon, I'd like to address the government's attempt at nationalization of two of the largest financial institutions in the United States, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. And for those of you who don't know, Fannie and Freddie are essentially insurance companies that insure against the risk of default by homeowners. And our story begins really back in March of 2008. When the Treasury Department started spreading rumors that Fannie and Freddie were mortally ill, were in terrible health, and might have to be nationalized. That was despite the fact that their regulators had given them a clean bill of health and continued up and through August to say that they were well capitalized. Moving forward to July, the Congress, at the urging of Secretary Paulson, passed a law known as HERA, that gave the government vast powers over Fannie and Freddie. And Secretary Paulson said this was a bazooka that he hoped not to have to fire. Well, sure enough, in September, a conservatorship was imposed. Treasury leaned very hard on the FHFA, the regulator of Fannie and Freddie, to change its conclusion and conclude that they were not adequately capitalized and that they needed to be put into conservatorship. And they were. And after being put into conservatorship, a deal was struck whereby the government agreed to make $100 billion available of funding to each of the two companies, and over time, the size of that funding commitment has grown. And the government, in return, got very generous terms, terms that would make Warren Buffett blush. They received, number one, 79.9% of the common stock of the companies. Number two, they received a liquidation preference of $2 billion. And number three, they received a dividend of either 10% if paid in cash or 12% if the companies elected to pay it in kind. Interestingly enough, the funds that were drawn from this line of commitment could not be repaid. To my knowledge, this is the only government bailout where the government insisted that they not be repaid. And right there we have a sign that there's something unusual about this. This wasn't a normal bailout where you had sick financial institutions that were in desperate need of help. There was a different agenda. And this was really a concrete life preserver that was thrown to Fannie and Freddie at a time when they really didn't need it in terms of getting this very expensive money, 10 or 12%, that could never be repaid or refinanced. In the aftermath of conservatorship, the government required the Fannie and Freddie to record large paper losses, notwithstanding the fact that the two companies were cash flow positive at all times during conservatorship. These paper losses took two forms. First were deferred tax assets, which included things like net operating loss carryforwards, which only have value if you have earnings against which you can use the NOLs. And the second were loan loss reserves. Now, it's important to note with respect to these paper losses that they were ultimately written back up. And so for those who say, well, this is a flawed business model of the GSEs, as they're known, the government-sponsored enterprises, this is a flawed business model, it's simply not true that if you look over the sweep over the last 10 years, the companies have done very well and, in fact, suffered far fewer credit losses than their big bank peers. Also, we see that the reserves that Fannie and Freddie were required to take were twice what was actually needed. and much higher on a percentage basis than what the governments, than what the big banks recorded during that time period. And there is litigation now, which I'll come back to, in Florida against Deloitte and PwC for artificially increasing the required write-downs. We move ahead in time, we see a couple of years into the conservatorship, the Obama administration in a memo from the Department of Treasury in December of 2010 saying that they have a commitment to ensure that common shareholders do not have an opportunity to participate in any earnings of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. That is really a breathtaking statement. That is tantamount to a Marxist regime saying that the private shareholders who own at this point 20.1% of the common stock will not, in fact, not have their property rights in any way honored and will be have those property rights wiped out. So we see that in December of 2010, that commitment has been made. And it was fulfilled on August 17th, 2012, a day that will live in infamy in the annals of American economic history when the net worth sweep was implemented. The net worth sweep, as its name suggests, the name that it was christened by the government with, entitles the Treasury to take every penny of profit and indeed net worth, all the capital from Fannie and Freddie in perpetuity, leaving nothing for the $33 billion of junior preferred shareholders who provided rescue capital even up through 2007 and 2008, and leaving nothing for the common shareholders. And, you know, the backdrop of this decision to take all the capital and all the net worth of the companies every quarter, we can see in running up to this decision on August 17th, 2012, that the companies in the second quarter of 2012 had announced very large, significant profits. Indeed, the week before the net worth sweep, the CFO of Fannie Mae had told the Treasury Department that they were going to have an additional $50 billion of earnings in 2013. And that same day, there was an email among the government saying, gee, we need to have a renewed push to really get this net worth sweep put into effect. On August 16th, the day before the sweep, we've now gained access to an internal government document showing that the government hoped and expected the companies to make more than the 10% cash dividend. And on August 17th, the day of the sweep, we have government emails celebrating that Fannie and Freddie will never be rehabilitated and will never come back as private companies. Under the sweep, the government has made $125 billion in extra profits to which it was not entitled. And as a consequence, we filed suit in July of 2013. Our first suit was in the Court of Federal Claims, and it said, this isn't Cuba. It's not Venezuela. You can't take property from private parties. And the government responded with a motion to dismiss. And in that motion to dismiss, they spun a counter narrative. They said, we didn't put the net worth sweep in place to take $125 billion of extra cash to which we were not entitled. No, we did it because we wanted to protect the line of commitment. We wanted to make sure that the companies would not burn through the line of commitment, unable to pay a 10% cash dividend on a liquidation preference, which at that point had reached $189 billion. And their theory was, so we're concerned that if the companies don't make $18.9 billion a year collectively, they might tap into the line of commitment to pay the dividend, and that would burn through the dividend. That was their story. Now, leave aside the procedural problem that this is a motion to dismiss and that the factual allegations of the complaint are supposed to be taken as true. There are three substantive problems with the government's counterfactual. Number one, the companies were poised to make huge profits, and everybody knew it. In fact, Fannie, as I indicated, had told Treasury that just the week before and had been telling FHFA that for several weeks before. Number two, there was no requirement to pay a 10% dividend. In fact, there's never a requirement to pay a dividend under Delaware law or any other state's law. In fact, if it would render you insolvent, you're forbidden from paying a cash dividend. Moreover, these agreements gave the companies the choice, empowered them to pay in kind, to make an additional stock dividend that increased the liquidation preference, but was not cash. And so that the option of being able to pay in kind rather than cash meant the companies in the FHFA had 100% control to ensure that that line of commitment was never touched to pay dividends. And it shows that their rationale of a death spiral is pretextual. And there's a third problem with their pretending that the reason they did this was to protect the line of commitment. And that's a structural problem. If we were sitting around a conference room and we were trying to come up with a regime that maximized the vulnerability and maximized the likelihood that a draw would have to be taken on the line of commitment, we would put a net worth sweep in place, because what it does is strip out all the capital off the balance sheets, leaving nothing but the line of commitment to absorb any losses that occur from quarter to quarter. And with these companies, with their balance sheets and the complexities of derivative accounting, it's highly likely that even though their business, core business, is strong, that from quarter to quarter, they will occasionally have losses. And of course, there's a business cycle to be contended with as well. So the deal that the government put in place, which of course enriched them to a great degree, and which they realized beforehand, also vitiates their main justification. It maximizes the vulnerability of the commitment. Now, as I indicated, this was a motion to dismiss, and when we got this brief, we went running to Judge Margaret Sweeney, and we said, Your Honor, they've violated the most fundamental principles of the motion to dismiss. They haven't accepted the allegations as true. We're entitled to discovery, and the court agreed, and we've now received almost a million pages of emails and other internal documents. We've taken depositions of many of the key figures, and we also received the mother of all privilege logs that was over 1,000 pages long. And we have filed a motion to compel to get a subset of those documents. We've also asked the court to require the government to go back and redo the privilege log in its entirety. The government has also asserted the presidential communication privilege. To my knowledge, this is only the second time in this administration's tenure that it has done so. The other time was in connection with a Fast and Furious investigation. And once the motion to compel is resolved in the Court of Federal Claims, then we will move on to amending our complaint, and then we will have additional briefing on the motion to dismiss. There'll be a renewed motion to dismiss. Now, the second piece of litigation was filed the next day by Gibson Dunn in the Perry Capital case and brought APA claims, and we followed the day after that with our own APA claim also in the District of Columbia on behalf of Fairholme. And we added a couple of counts that weren't in the Perry Capital complaint. We had a breach of contract claim. We had a breach of implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing claim and a breach of fiduciary duty claim. Now, with respect to the Administrative Procedures Act, the main claim that both we and Perry Capital are advancing is that these are not the acts of a conservator, and that they violate HERA. We say, number one, HERA requires the conservator to operate these companies in a sound and solvent manner. And in modern financial institution regulation, soundness has a meaning. It means capital. And stripping every penny of capital off the balance sheet of massively large financial institutions is the opposite of sound. So we say, point one, that's the first violation. The next is that the statute requires the FHFA to preserve and conserve the assets. And rather than preserving and conserving assets, they are sending off, siphoning off to the tune of tens of billions of dollars, over $100 billion of profits to the federal government impermissibly. Third, the companies are supposed to be rehabilitated under the statute. And this regime ensures that they can never be rehabilitated. A financial institution without capital is the opposite of a rehabilitated institution. And the government understood that, and that's why Jim Parrott of the White House on the day of the net worth sweep was celebrating with those who are opposed to the GSEs that In fact, the network suite made sure that the companies would never again return to their prior status. And fourth, that Hera, of course, uses the term conservator, and that has a well-established meaning in the law. It means a fiduciary, it means a trustee. And one of the interesting amicus briefs that was submitted in the litigation was put in by Tom Vartanian and Mike Criminger. They both put in briefs. Collectively, they have supervised hundreds, if not close to 1,000 conservatorships under the FDIC's identical statute. And they both said that they never did exercise any of the types of powers similar to a network sweep, and they never would have for precisely the reasons I've just articulated. They did not have that power when they were at the FDIC, and the FHFA does not have that power either. So what does the government say? Well, they first say that the courts cannot review their conduct under the statute 4617F. They say there's a jurisdictional bar and that these provisions can't be reviewed. But even Judge Lamberth rejected that argument and acknowledged that if FHFA has violated the statute, they can be enjoined from continuing to violate HERA. So there really is common ground, and the government has reluctantly agreed to this too. There is common ground among the parties that if in fact HERA has been violated, the courts have the authority and indeed the duty to enjoin them. So then on the merits, what do they say? Well, first of all, they raise the death spiral argument, and we've already talked about why that's a factually flawed premise. They knew they were going to get huge profits. They claim, well, we didn't know that. We had an outside expert analyst, Grant Thornton, who provided us with projections showing that the companies really were going to fall very short of the $18.9 billion necessary to service the cash dividend. And the answer to that is, number one, those Grant Thornton projections were 11 months old at the time of the sweep. They were done as of September 2011. And number two, the government in fact knew, based on what Fannie was telling it right up to the net worth sweep, that the projections had become significantly more optimistic, and we can add accurate, we know now with the benefit of hindsight, and that they were poised to enter the golden age of earnings, and the government knew that. The government also says in support of the death spiral that, well, the pick option that I referenced, that's a penalty. But in fact, if you look at what the Treasury Department told the SEC and the OMB, and this is in their own official administrative record that they provided, they called the pick an option, and that's clearly what it is. It's an option that provides financial flexibility for the companies if they, for whatever reason, prefer not to pay a cash dividend, including wanting to preserve the line of commitment. The government also says, well, look, you can't look at the purpose behind our actions, and that's wrong for a few reasons. Number one, the statute itself, in conferring power on the FHFA, says it is for certain purposes. So the statute imports this concept of purpose, which is very familiar to administrative law, into the regime and into the analysis. And the Leon County Court in the 11th Circuit agrees with that. But even if the government were right, and even if we were going to blind ourselves to what their real purpose was, and that we only looked at the effect, the government would still lose because the effect is to strip out every penny of capital and leave the companies in a fundamentally unsound position. Now, the government's last line of defense, its Manchino line of defense, is what's called the periodic commitment fee. Under the original terms of the deal, the government was also entitled to a market-based fee for the value of the commitment. And the market-based value of the fee, according to internal Freddie Mac documents, which we obtained in discovery and have now been unsealed, is approximately 25 basis points or $400 million. So even though the government put in an affidavit from an FHFA employee saying that it would be incalculably large, we now know that the companies themselves didn't think it was incalculably large based on their market data. It would be $400 million a year, and that's obviously a number that, given the $125 billion of excess profits the companies have enjoyed in recent years over and above the 10% threshold, would not have been difficult to service. Switching to our focus to the Treasury Department, our APA claims also point out that Treasury had no authority to purchase new securities after December 31, 2009. And this is plainly a new security. They went from getting a 10 or 12% dividend to having a claim to 100% of the profits. This has the clear attributes of common stock. And in fact, the Treasury's own revenue rulings in the tax context, when taxpayers have come to them with similar types of transactions, they have said, this is a new security. And the government wants to try to exalt form over substance to say, well, we have the same piece of paper in our hand and we just amended some of the terms and we're confident that form will not be exalted over substance. In terms of the common law claims that we brought in our complaint, there's breach of contract, both for the voting rights. There were voting rights that have been violated. There was also the concept of a dividend stopper, and that means having the ability to receive as a junior preferred shareholder. One of the things you get is if there are dividends being paid out on common, which is essentially what's happening now with the government sweeping all the profits, the junior preferred shareholders have a contractual right to be paid first. There's also the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, the central premise of which is that no one would ever have agreed to give Fannie and Freddie $33 billion of capital if they had known the government could come riding in and say, we're going to remove you from the capital structure and we're going to take all the profits for ourselves. And then the third common law count is a breach of fiduciary duty count. And this basically says the conservator was charged with the duties of a trustee, and it cannot line the pockets of a related entity, here Treasury, at the cost of and at the expense of its ward. And so those are the basic common law counts. Now, Judge Lamberth agreed with the government almost across the board and granted the motion to dismiss. And we have now fully briefed this in front of the D.C. Circuit, which held argument on April 15th in front of Judges Brown, Ginsburg, and Millett. One of the more interesting parts of that argument, I thought, was when Judge Ginsburg suggested in a question to Treasury, he said, so what you've said here is that you salted the earth so nothing could grow back again. And I thought that was a very vivid and apt analogy, an appropriate analogy, for what the government did here. By taking the capital out of Fannie and Freddie, they really did salt the earth so that they could never be rehabilitated and never grow back to be a vibrant, healthy financial institution. The D.C. Circuit recently, some of you may know, issued a series of questions about subject matter jurisdiction with respect to the breach of fiduciary duty claim against Treasury for damages. That's not a claim we brought. There is a class action that is being brought by Boies Schiller. And in that complaint, they did seek money damages against Treasury, and that briefing was just submitted this week. You know, one thing I would point out is that the answer to these questions aren't going to have any impact on the APA or the breach of contract or implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, nor against claim for equitable relief against Treasury. There are other suits pending, bringing APA suits. One of those is in Kentucky. There is a hearing scheduled at 1 p.m. Next Thursday in front of Judge Amol Thapar, and that case is the one that is farthest along. There's also a case pending in the Northern District of Iowa, and there's a case pending in the Northern District of Illinois in front of Edmund Chang. And those cases, they all have some differences, but at the core of them, they are advancing APA claims. There is also a suit in Delaware being brought by former Chief Justice of the Delaware Supreme Court, Myron Steele. The basic thrust and thesis of that suit is that under Delaware law, preferred stock has to have a rate. And this preferred stock doesn't have a rate. It's essentially common stock. As I've said, it's a residual claim to the profits. And so that suit posits that under Delaware law, it's very clear that the net worth sweep is null and void and has to be invalidated. There are two other suits, one against Fannie, one against Freddie, in Delaware and Virginia, respectively, seeking access to their books and records. The discovery that we were allowed to take by Judge Sweeney was largely confined and on a temporal basis to the period before September 30, 2012. And so we haven't had an opportunity to see very many, if any, documents thereafter. And the books and records request, which is not something we've had anything to do with, but we're following. I believe that one of the forms of relief that will be sought is to get some additional information. Certainly, if that does become public, I think that will be of interest to all. And then there's a suit down in Florida, which I adverted to towards the beginning of this call, where PwC and Deloitte, I believe, have both been sued by shareholders saying that they were conspiring with the government to artificially increase the paper losses, which had the effect of increasing the liquidation preference and thereby increasing the dividend that had to be paid and thereby making it less likely that Fannie and Freddie would be able to remain vibrant entities that could meet these cash dividends. So that's a quick 360-degree tour of the various lawsuits. And Dean, I will turn it back to you.
Well, thank you so much. You covered a lot of territory there, Forrest. We certainly appreciate it. Let's check in with the audience, see if they have questions in a moment. We'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert, we have about 30 minutes left. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone while we're waiting to see who might ring in. Let me remind callers that we have a fairly full schedule of teleform calls next week, beginning on Monday with a look at Alexander Bickel's classic article, The Least Dangerous Branch. This is a continuation of our series of legal classics. That will be Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern time at this same number. Today, of course, we're talking about Freddie, Fannie, the GSEs, and all the litigation with David Thompson, the litigator. We've got one question pending. If you'd like to join that queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Before we take that first question, let me just ask what I think is a good follow-up question for you, Mr. Thompson, and that's what can we expect next in terms of hearing from these various courts? And relatedly, what happens despite decisions going one way or another in these courts? Are there automatic, do we expect the parties to go on up the ladder? Do we need a circuit split to get to the Supreme Court?
Yes, great question, Dean. So I would say first, you know, with the D.C. Circuit, we do expect to get a ruling this summer. The briefing is continuing with respect to the order that they just released a couple of weeks ago on some of these threshold jurisdictional questions. So that may or may not have delayed them a little bit. But I would suspect in early August or mid-August, we will hear from the D.C. Circuit. Likewise, Judge Thapar has a reputation and a well-earned reputation for being a very not only thorough and thoughtful, but very fast judge. And so we expect to hear from him in short order. He had originally indicated there was an MDL proceeding, which the government had brought, tried to consolidate all the cases, which was rejected. But as part of that, Judge Thapar had stayed his hand and said if the MDL panel had not ruled by July 1, he was going to unstay his hand and rule by the end of this month. Now, he's got a hearing next Thursday that's scheduled, so I don't know that he'll stick to the end of this month, but it's an indication that he plans to move this case through expeditiously. And I do think this is, you know, one of those types of cases where you're talking about two just huge financial institutions, two of the largest in the United States, if not the world, two of the most profitable companies in the world that have been effectively nationalized with no statutory authority whatsoever. In fact, in the face of very clear statutory dictates to the contrary. And I think this is the type of case that even in the absence of a circuit split, you know, the Supreme Court would be very interested in taking a look at.
Very good. Again, if you have a question for David Thompson, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Just one question pending, so let's get started with that one.
My name is Fred Young. I would like to ask the obvious question in terms of motivation. Is this a part of the political agenda of Obama and Clinton to advance to progressivism by nationalizing these institutions.
Well, I think that's an interesting point. You know, candidly, I am no fan of either of the two individuals you mentioned, but I can say that one of the things that's been disheartening about this is the bipartisan nature of the disregard for property rights. As I said at the beginning of the call, Secretary Paulson was at the epicenter of this effort. These companies were essentially cash flow positive. Sure, they were going to take some credit losses, as did Wells Fargo and J.P. Morgan, but they were a far cry from, you know, the sort of being in distress and being needed to be put into conservatorship. And it was the Bush administration that really got this ball rolling. But you're certainly right. You know, we really see in the Obama administration that December 2010 memo saying that they have a commitment, that the administration, it says, has a commitment to ensure that these common shareholders don't receive any money. It's really breathtaking that they would be so bold, so open about that policy. It is breathtaking, as though they are not familiar with the most basic principles of the Fifth Amendment or the Takings Clause, let alone the Administrative Procedures Act. So it has been. The other thing we've seen is, and this sort of gets a little bit outside of my realm of expertise, but in terms of the political theater and motivations that are going on in Congress, but we have seen people on both sides of the aisle make negative comments about some of the investors. And I hasten to add that many of these investors are mom and pops and individuals. I remember well an article in the Washington Post by James K. Glassman many years ago saying that Fannie and Freddie were like Johnson & Johnson and IBM stocks you should just buy and hold forever. And there were lots of people who did that and lots of people who suffered as a result of the government's conduct. Some political opponents of Fannie and Freddie have seized on the fact that there are hedge funds and mutual funds that are involved in this litigation to say, well, we shouldn't let them, you know, speculators receive, you know, profits from this. Now, this was exactly the same argument that Alexander Hamilton confronted when the question was, is the federal government going to assume the debt of the states? And some said, well, some of that debt is held by speculators. And he said, that doesn't matter. There are property rights at stake. We need to honor the property rights, number one. And number two, if we want to have good credit, you know, we need to be particularly certain to honor those rights. And, you know, I look at this from a systemic point of view. If you look at the ability of financial institutions who are in distress to raise rescue capital, and of the $33 billion of junior preferred stock, two-thirds of it was raised in 2007, 2008, when the waters were a little choppy. And these companies were able to raise $20 billion. And the next time there's a crisis and another large financial institution needs to raise capital, if they're even able to do it, I submit it will be a lot more expensive if the government is allowed to set this precedent of coming in and say, we're allowed to take it. And that is the position they're taking in their papers, which is, well, people didn't have a reasonable investment-backed expectation they'd get their money back. They should have known we would come in and take it all for ourselves, which is really a breathtaking proposition.
Paul Alinsky said, whatever it takes.
That's right.
I see this as a political gambit as opposed to legal, which I'm not arguing with you. You're the lawyer, but it's just blatant.
Yeah, no, there certainly is a political dimension to this.
Once again, if you have a question, if you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending. Let's take another call.
Good afternoon. This is Carl Domino calling from Florida. One of the things that makes this hard to follow is there's so many plaintiffs, so many cases, so many legal theories. So let me ask a question about the end result. Are the remedies, were all these suits, all the plaintiffs successful, would the remedies be roughly similar or equal, or are there some cases that would result in far different remedies?
Well, that is a great question, and it's a little bit complicated, but let me try to boil this down. So obviously, at a high level of generality, there are two types of relief. There's the possibility of injunctive relief and the possibility of damages. Now, if there is an injunction saying that the net worth sweep is void, I believe that would operate on a nationwide basis and would, and all shareholders would benefit equally from such a ruling. Now, by the way, footnote, that injunction could either be take the form of treating the excess payments, $125 billion, as a pay down of principal. It's actually slightly more than that. And or it could be, hey, Treasury, you need to pay the money back. Okay, so that's an injunction, and that would operate the same throughout the country. Now, there's also the possibility of damages. In the federal system, there is the case in the Court of Federal Claims for takings. And there, as you know, the general rule is that the value of a taking is measured as the value of the property at the time of the taking. In the breach of contract, it's a different measure and metric, and you have restitution, reliance, expectancy. But to my knowledge, that breach of contract claim is only pending in the federal court system in the District of Columbia for D.C., or now the D.C. Circuit. And so I don't think there's really a risk of inconsistent or different resolutions. That's a class action in D.C., so everyone presumably would be part of that class. And the Court of Federal Claims action is also a class action, also filed by Boy Schiller. And then, you know, those are the, there's also the Florida case against PwC and Deloitte. Now, those could be, I don't know what sort of damages they have in mind there, but again, there's only one suit like that to my knowledge in the United States. So yes, there could be different forms of relief, but I don't think we're going to be in a profile where, well, one court orders breach of contract damages of X and another one of Y. It's not going to be like that. I think everyone will get the, is similarly situated, will get the same thing.
Our, well, our lines are wide open now. If you'd like to join the conversation, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've still got some time left. While we're waiting to see if somebody else rings in, let me ask you another question here. You mentioned soundness and a term of art that I guess is well litigated or at least well understood, and that stripping capital from an entity like this is per se not sound. I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I think it was something.
That's right.
Is there an argument to be had on the other side that that just doesn't apply here, that these regular standards don't apply when you're talking about two entities that are government corporations that enjoy the backing of the government, that soundness should be described and defined dramatically differently?
They haven't articulated, they haven't had the chutzpah to say that. I think what, you know, and it's hard to know what they really are saying. But what they might try to say is, well, look, you know, we were trying to protect the line of commitment. That's part of the soundness inquiry. That's, you know, a value, that's an important backstop, they might say. And I think the problems they have with that are, number one, that's not on the balance sheet. That's not real capital. A commitment is not capital, number one. Number two, we know that this whole argument is pretextual because they designed a system that maximizes the vulnerability of the commitment by taking the capital. If they hadn't done the net worth sweep, these two companies would have $125 billion on their balance sheet right now, standing between the next quarter of losses and the commitment. And instead, all of that is gone. That huge buffer, which would have been, you know, there probably for decades, has been totally eliminated. So, you know, they're in a tough spot, Dean, because, you know, if a court looks at soundness, I really don't see how we could lose.
And if, again, if you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask you this. I have heard, maybe not in a government argument, but some of the public policy arguments being offered by other people, it might come down to an equitable argument, I suppose, something to the effect of, without the government's intervention here, the GSEs just wouldn't exist any longer. The bondholders would have zero, therefore they're entitled to zero. Is that argument being asserted in court?
Well, they're not. They're trying to paint themselves as the white knight who came in 2008 and saved the day. And, you know, how outrageous it is for, you know, any shareholder or bondholder to come forward and complain now. And there's a factual problem with that, and there's a legal problem with that argument. The factual problem is it's just not true. You know, these companies sustained far smaller losses than Wells Fargo on a percentage basis, and J.P. Morgan, their regulator in August of 2012, said they were in, you know, that they were well capitalized and in good shape. And you know, the tell, Dean, is the concrete nature of this life preserver. When does the government ever put together a bailout package where it can't be repaid? You know, so there were, you know, that you can't repay the money. What's up with that? It was very clear that, you know, the administration did not want these entities coming back to life. So that's the, first of all, the factual problem. They weren't the white knight. They were the black knight coming in with a concrete life preserver. The second point is a legal one. Even if it were true, and it's not, but even if it were true that they came in and they saved the day in 2008, in August of 2012, they had to comply with HERA. And HERA has very specific things about operating them soundly, preserve and conserve assets, and rehabilitate them. And if they, you know, if the administration, either the Bush administration or the Obama administration, did not want to have to rehabilitate them, go back to Congress, get the law changed. You know, but they didn't do that. They weren't able to do that. And they are stuck with a law that says rehabilitate them, and they're not doing that. So, but you're right, Dean. They're absolutely trying to conjure the image of the knight in shining armor who saved the day.
So you've said a lot about conservatorship, and I'll ask you this final question, then we'll call it a quits here unless we get an audience question. Was receivership an option? Receivership, I take it, where the government would have more latitude to not have to conserve the assets and have an ongoing entity. Was receivership an option here, and when did that stop being an option, and why wasn't that option exercised rather than conservatorship?
Well, yeah, and I can't – you know, speak to all the reasons they would have not done it. But number one, you know, I think the private shareholders would be in much better position right now if they just put them in receivership at the time of the net worth sweep. They at least have their liquidation preference. These companies are generating huge cash flows. You know, if their assets and liabilities were sold off, there probably would have been plenty of money to pay off at par the junior preferreds and money left over for the common. So that's one point, which is, you know, I don't know that receivership would have been disastrous, you know, in August of 2012. The government didn't do it earlier because Fannie and Freddie play a critical role in terms of ability of, you know, anyone with a mortgage has benefited from Fannie and Freddie because, you know, they are providing insurance, and with the backstop, you know, people are able to get mortgages at a very attractive rate. And so, you know, it really would have had a devastating effect on the housing market if they had been put in receivership. And that was the last thing that the Bush or the Obama administration wanted to do. And I'm not, you know, saying this based on any, you know, emails or information I'm saying, but just I think as a matter of basic common economic sense, this is the last thing that, you know, anyone would have wanted to do. I don't know of anyone other than sort of the most militant anti-GSE hater who was suggesting they should have been put into receivership. I think the perceived, you know, knowledge was that that would have had devastating effects on the housing market at the time that the housing market needed to be supported, not, you know, hit again.
Final call for questions. If you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Looks like we do have one more question.
Hi, this is Warren Belmar calling. Question as to the condition of Fannie and Freddie in 2008. Are you saying that if the government didn't step in, they would have been okay?
Yeah, I think there's a very real possibility of that. They were, as I said a couple of times, they had fewer credit losses on a percentage basis than the big money center banks did. And those banks were able to, you know, survive the tough times and make it through. And the losses that we see from Fannie and Freddie were big paper losses. They were twice. They were forced to take losses that were twice what they actually sustained. So those paper losses turned to paper gains in later years, which of course benefited the government. because then it was able to sweep those profits in. So I think there's a very real possibility. And the companies, of course, had been able to raise private capital in May of 2008. I believe it was Freddie, although I apologize if it was Fannie, but one of the two of them in May of 2008 was able to raise $7 billion of capital. So they had not been closed off from the capital markets. And I believe they could have thrived in the same way that Wells Fargo did. They were cash flow positive every single quarter of the recession.
When you say paper losses, those are unrealized losses. What was the magnitude of the unrealized loss before the government stepped in?
Oh, I don't, you know, I apologize. I don't have the quarterly numbers from the beginning of 2008 memorized, but I don't believe that they were significant to any extent at all. I mean, remember, in August of 2012, the FHFA, before Treasury started leaning on them, said that they were well capitalized. So whatever losses they had weren't sufficient to, you know, threaten their capital levels.
Last question. What was the stock price before the government stepped in of the common stock of Fannie and Freddie?
I know what it was on the day before the net worth sweep, which was the preferred, junior preferred, was about $2 a share. I don't know what it was back in 2008. It was obviously had gone a lot lower in March. I started the call by saying in March of 2008, the Treasury Department started spreading rumors, you know, about Fannie and Freddie needing to be rationalized. Those appears in Barron's magazine, I believe, on a front page article. That obviously had a very negative effect on the stock price, and it continued to be pushed down thanks to, you know, Treasury negative PR through the summer. And of course, all financial stocks, you know, whether it's Morgan Stanley or Goldman or Wells Fargo, were getting hit very hard. You know, at that point, there was significant turbulence, to be sure, but conservatorship was a real overreaction.
Thank you.
Well, I think we've had our final question, David Thompson. Let me give you a minute or two to express a final thought, if you have one.
Well, I think, Dean, just to go back to the reality that at the end of the day, this is about the rule of law. This is about property rights. I believe this is the most massive taking of property in the history of the United States of America. It's also one of the most flagrantly illegal acts in violation of a number of very clear statutory provisions. And I remain very optimistic that the court system is not going to allow this administration to get away with this.
Well, I certainly appreciate your time. You've covered a lot of territory. There's a lot at stake here, as you've described. I hope we can have you back as a guest on Teleforum, perhaps to celebrate or discuss the next step in the litigation, as the case might be. To our audience, thank you as well for joining us today, and thank you for your thoughtful questions. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call, Monday at 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about Bickel's classic article, The Least Dangerous Branch. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.